House Committee on Ways and Means, or House Committee on Revenue, excuse me. I've changed the focus of our committee today. But we are going to go back to revenue right now. For Wednesday, May 9th, 2007, we'll come to order. We're going to start at the wrong end of our agenda today and open a work session on House Bill 2961. Committee, this bill has had an interesting recent history, and I wanted to get on the record the conversations that have been had concerning the issue of the referral to Ways and Means. The original referral from the Speaker included a referral to Ways and Means. The Ways and Means Committee has over 200 policy bills in the Ways and Means Committee, and we're trying to do a little triage on that so that they don't have to deal with every single issue. There have been conversations with the House co-chair, who has agreed that this is one of those bills that does not need to go to Ways and Means. It contains within it the fees to fund it and the mechanism for distributing the fees and the criteria for doing that. And therefore, it is her view that this bill does not need a Ways and Means referral.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. It's my understanding that the House co-chair is working with the Senate co-chair and making certain that the appropriation of the funds that we're talking about does, in fact, go back to the law schools, and that they are making that allowance for appropriation based upon the fact that we will be passing this House bill through the House with anticipation it will go through the Senate. If it does not make it through the entire process as the bill presently collects monies, then they will adjust in the omnibus bill and the Ways and Means. Therefore, it does not need to be referred, and we can continue forward with this without the referral.
Thank you. I think that's an excellent summary, Representative Butler, of the situation. And you can see that Paul is scribbling notes to make certain that he has contact the Legislative Fiscal Office to make sure that actually happens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Secondly, Mr. Chair.
Exactly. And he's got his green pen out. That's always a good
always sign. A good sign. Yes.
Mr. Chair, the second question was that Merle Weiner yesterday talked about the bill collecting revenues of approximately $66,000 per each of three law schools, and I think that the revenue impact from the revenue office is slightly different, and we need to make sure that we do get the correct amount as defined by the revenue office. I think her anticipation was something in the vicinity of $200,000 total for the current biennium, and revenue indicates $350,000, so that number will then need to be communicated.
Representative Butler, those numbers were obtained actually through fiscal office, through the judicial department. But I will talk with them and confirm those numbers.
Okay. Just that there was a slightly different, Mr. Chair, a slightly different testimony than what we have, so that the numbers that the co-chairs can finalize on for the law schools on behalf of the domestic violent programs collected from this fee will be correct.
Representative Butler, these numbers do match up with what's on your fiscal impact statement.
Yes, and that. But there was different testimony yesterday. I just wanted to call that to attention.
Right. And
thank you.
And I think also, Representative Butler, if I recall, the budget that Professor Weiner was talking about would not provide the entire cost of the program, that in fact it was actually significantly more than that. This fiscal that we have here is not out of line, I think, with the numbers that she expected would be the actual expense of the program. So I don't believe we're in any trouble on that issue.
You're right, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, what's your pleasure on the A. Gross to House Bill 2961? We don't have any proposed amendments, do we, Paul?
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We're in public hearing.
We are in work session.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Olson.
I would move that House Bill 2961A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Olson moves House Bill 29.
Do you want to ask for a rescission of the...
Yes. And would you include in your motion a rescission of the Ways and Means referral?
I will.
Thank you. So Representative Olson moves House Bill 2961A to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a request for a rescission of the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Do pass with amendments, and well, actually, we don't have amendments on this bill. Do pass with a rescission of subsequent referral. Discussion of that motion. Without discussion, please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Excused.
Aye.
Aye. And Representative Olson, would you carry the bill?
I will.
The bill has received the required majority vote and will go to the floor. Assuming we get the rescission of the subsequent referral, then Representative Olson will carry the bill on the floor. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2961. Next, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3064 and House Bill 3065. Mary.
Yes. Thank you. House Bill 3064 directs an assessment by cost approach for intangible property of communication companies, provides that an intangible property may not account for more than 20% of each communication company's property tax bill, takes effect upon becoming law. Under current law, intangible property of centrally assessed companies are subject to property tax. Centrally assessed properties are typically the larger industrials, electricity providers, and communication providers. They provide services usually to more than one county. The Department of Revenue performs the assessment on these properties. Smaller, otherwise comparable companies that serve one company are assessed by the tax assessor of the county in which the property is located. The local assessors are not permitted to impose property tax on intangible property, so there lies the difference in treatment of large versus centrally small versus centrally assessed properties. The Department of Revenue currently imposes a property tax on intangibles because it applies a unitary approach to centrally assessed properties. That is, the unitary approach applies that the department looks at a number of factors, including income and cost, in order to come up with a total picture of what the value of the property is worth. And as with any business, the value of the property is worth more than the sum of the breakup value. And that's why they take that approach, and that's why to date it's been difficult, or it is difficult for them to break up and determine what the actual intangible component is. And so in some states, we've reported on this during the interim, in some states different methods have been used, because some states do exempt intangibles, and sometimes they just lop off a chunk and say 10%, and that's what it's going to be, or some other states may use a different approach.
Sure. Thank you very much. We have a number of witnesses to be heard today on this bill, and we have other business as well, so we appreciate witnesses hitting their main points and allowing time for others to be heard. We have a panel to be called first, Mr. Dewey, Mr. Harris, Mr. Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. You have written testimony. I will not read that. With me is Roger Hurst on my left, with Crestview Cable, a small cable operator in central and eastern Oregon, and a commercial appraiser on my right, Kent Osborne, who I've worked with on some litigation and also some property tax cases, one going back to 1988. I'm going to hit both bills, and I want to try and set the stage here, if I may. The Department of Revenue last fall told the Revenue Interim Committee, some of you may recall this, that cable companies and internet companies will be centrally assessed in 08 or 09 based on the issues that are presented to the Department of Revenue in a meeting yesterday. If there is potentially no action taken by the legislature, we will see central assessment. I'll talk about the effect of that in just a minute. But if your property tax bill goes up, let's say, 3 to 6 times, and that can't occur under central assessment from the cost approach, which cable companies today are appraised under a cost approach, and you move to central assessment and you take the entirety of the company and use the income approach, based on a court case that we litigated in 1990, and based on an appraisal that Mr. Osborne did of a private Oregon cable company, the increase could be, again, 3 to 6 times. The Jones Intercable case in Douglas County, it was litigated, and the tax court found for the plaintiff, again, Jones Intercable, they found that, that the appraisal was not correct, not appropriate, and useful. But again, the increase in this case was 5 times the amount of property taxes. Now, I will tell you that cable companies, the number we have is at least $30 million in franchise fees, not a small sum, and millions of dollars in property taxes today. The dilemma we run into is ORS 308-505 sub 2, and that's the definition of communication. And it includes, and I'm quoting, telephone communication, telegraph communication, and data transmission by whatever means provided. Now, the local cable company is morphed into something other than a video company, but recognize the majority of the revenues for a cable company are from the video side. But we'll take it. Comcast and Mr. Harris will talk about the services that they are providing, the effect they could have on very small rural communities. But we'll take a Comcast, a Bed Broadband, let's take a Charter, and they're providing a high-speed data service on Comcast.net, for example. Some of you may have that service. And they are providing now, and it's nascent at this point in time, telephone services. So I would say and recognize that with regard to this statute, which was written in 1973, and in some ways, it's very interesting because it uses data transmission. And I was here in 1973, and I don't even know if I knew what that meant in 1973. Didn't look at the bill at that point in time. But it also says telegraph. So it's a very interesting statute. So by virtue of taking that statute and then also taking the definition of what can be taxed when you're a communication company, intangibles come into play, and the income approach can be used. So at the local level, what you have is you have the cost approach. So it's your, what is the real value of the buildings? What is the value of the property and equipment? Depreciation plus replacement value. You move to central assessment by the Department of Revenue, and we don't quarrel with the department doing the assessment. We would quarrel with the methodology. So at the Department of Revenue level, you have a whole, if you will, new way of doing the appraisal. The income approach is utilized. The market approach, where appropriate, may be utilized. And the cost approach may be appropriate. But again, in terms of the appraisals we've seen, by virtue of taking the entirety and putting intangibles into the mix, like a franchise, contracts, programming contracts, goodwill, and there's a whole list, That significantly increases the property taxes. Now, what I wanted to talk about a little bit is for you to understand that, for example, competitors of ours, Quest and Verizon, are centrally assessed, as are wireless companies. There is precedent for making some changes here in that the wireless companies received a few years back an exemption or a carve-out of the spectrum, the wireless license. And that was done because they bought that spectrum at different times for different prices based on the FCC auctions. So they're all providing the same service by and large, but some paid a lot more for that particular spectrum, and the legislature carved that out. Now, I mentioned to you that our primary revenues are on the video side, and our primary competition would be the satellite companies, Dish Network, DirecTV, and the like. They do not pay any franchise fees. Now, somebody would say, well, they're not in the right-of-way, but the vast majority of the franchise fees that cable companies pay go to the general fund. They don't go to manage the right-of-way. They go to the general fund. And they clearly, because there's not a nexus, they do not pay any property taxes. So when we get a significant increase in our property tax bill, if nothing happens with regard to one of these bills, do we raise rates? If we raise rates, we lose customers. We're in a situation where we employ, in the cable companies, over 2,000 folks. In Oregon, we connect to libraries, we connect to local governments, schools, and the like, and provide these services literally at no cost. So it's one of those situations where you have to look at the effect that this is going to have. Now, I do want to point out the word data, because I believe that there are other companies that will come under the scrutiny that cable companies and internet companies have come under by the Department of Revenue. I don't know what a data company is. I believe that Google, which is coming to the Dalles, is a data company, and I think they would be centrally assessed. The Oregon Software Association was going to be here today, and right before the hearing I received an email that the individual that was going to come down had some car issues and was not able to be here, but they were going to basically say the same thing. They would have concerns if some of their members, which are data companies in my opinion, we come into the new methodology, if you will. And I say to you that if you look at this issue, it's going to be very interesting for the department to define what a data company is, and I'd like to hear what they have to say about that. And secondly, how do you tax the entirety of the company when you couldn't tax the video revenues, but that's the basis by which the infrastructure was built, and that's the majority of the revenue. 13 states do tax intangibles. In 05, Kentucky did away with it, and in 06, Utah did away with it. I'll leave you with a few more, if you will, situations. One is, Mr. Osborne will tell you that by using the income approach to taxation, it is, in effect, an income tax. And I say that because, and he can do it more eloquently than I can, but it essentially is a tax on your income. And if you made money in the state of Oregon, you're going to be paying income taxes today. And I leave with just, and Representative Butler and I have had this conversation, but I leave with you this, and then the others will speak. I leave this, let's take a McDonald's and Representative Butler's hamburger stand in Ontario.
Taco Tom's.
Okay, whatever it is. But you've got McDonald's. And McDonald's is a multinational corporation. You have to have a franchise. They do a lot of advertising. Now, Representative Butler has exactly the same building, exactly the same equipment. The location is the same in that they're across the street from each other, so there's no advantage whatsoever. I suggest, notwithstanding the proper management that Representative Butler has, that McDonald's will do a little bit better. And I saw that with growing up here and sailing with Bob's with the McDonald's across the street. And what I'm saying to you is they have all the same equipment, all the same location, but under the central assessment approach, McDonald's is going to be paying substantially more. But they're already paying income taxes. So why ought not they have an income, they ought not to have an income approach on their property. I don't think it's very fair. Now, you're going to hear from local government in the sense that, you know, they're going to lose revenue. I mean, it's very clear if nothing happens, the potential is for them to gain significant revenue. It's almost a windfall for them because there are so many data companies in the state of Oregon. Mr. Harris is going to talk briefly about the investments they've made and whether or not they would make these investments with the understanding that their property taxes could go up significantly. So, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind.
Thank you.
Chair, committee members. I'm Roger Harris. I'm with Crestview Cable Communications. We operate cable television systems in Prineville, Madras, Lapine, and Enterprise, Oregon. I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you in this matter. While the state has been very proactive in trying to promote the enhancement and the availability of broadband services in rural areas of the state, there's a lot of operators, cable operators like myself, who've been in it for a while, who've done this for a while. For example, we've been providing broadband high-speed internet service in Prineville and Madras since 2000. And just last year, we began offering high-speed data services, internet services in Lapine and in another area we serve called Crooked River Ranch, which is kind of a planned development down in Central Oregon as well. Some technology partnerships, a lot of things have become possible to make it more viable for cable operators such as us to begin offering even the smaller systems. I mean, we have a fairly robust service we're offering in those areas, and it's going to continue to grow, and it's going to continue to get faster. And also, we've signed a deal. We will be launching VoIP in Prineville, Madras, and Lapine in 2007. Well, VoIP is Voice over Internet Protocol. It's the Internet voice service. So rural as we may be, we have opportunities to move forward and provide these services that I know every one of you have heard people want, you know, just to go more into the rural areas. I would say that one, you might notice I did not mention we're offering these in Enterprise, and because we have not began offering the service to Enterprise Oregon as of yet, and with doing what we're doing right now, completing a rebuild in Lapine, and launching the VoIP plus some high-definition video, et cetera, our resources are stretched pretty thin for 2007. With the knowledge it's a possibility we will be centrally accessed, and by going into the data services, we could be subject to a 3 to 6-fold increase in our property taxes, I don't know that we could afford to offer the broadband services in Enterprise. We would have to have a significant successful launch in a year to come up with the difference. It is that substantial. When you start, because if we weren't, the way this, the old statute is interpreted or could be interpreted, right now we're not subject to central assessment for the Enterprise system. The minute we offer data, we are. And in a small system, we still have the hardware cost. We're going to have to increase the infrastructure, the hardware cost for our video. I mean, and that's substantial for our primary core business. But by just rolling out a new service to have that property taxes jump on that same equipment 4 to 6 times, it may make this impossible. What it would do to our businesses in Prineville, Madras, and Lapine is substantial. It would be, I can tell you, in the Prineville Madras issue systems, it could be $150,000 to $200,000 a year, easily. And those are not very large systems. That is an incredible financial impact. We would have to change the way we do business. I'll be real upfront with you. I'm not blowing any smoke. It's a very substantial amount of money to absorb in those kind of systems. We have millions invested in these systems, even though they're small, to provide these services, and we're paying property taxes, income taxes on our investment. And I would ask that something move forward to address this bill, to clarify it, and that you consider what its impact will have on rural Oregon for the deployment of these types of services. If anyone in the business is going to be subject to property taxes, it's going to be very hard to recover your expenses in rural Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair, committee members, I am Ken Osborne, a certified appraiser in the state with experience in appraising a variety of assets, including the companies in question today. What I have to say will be brief and will address one nuts and bolts appraisal issue that may be of interest to the committee. The under the central assessment, the property tax paid by these companies is likely to increase by a factor of 3 to 6. It's difficult to be more precise than that because of a lack of consensus in the appraisal profession about the methodology to use to appraise in a situation like this, but 3 to 6 times is my finding based on preliminary studies. Now, under the current method, the cost approach values only the tangible assets of the business and is often proportional more or less to the net book value of the tangible assets of the business. Now, these businesses tend to have a large part of the business value that is in intangible assets. And so when these businesses are bought and sold, it's often at a price that may be 3 times plus or minus the net book value of the assets. This is significant. It makes these companies different, in my view, from other assets that have had this approach, the central assessment used before. The main point I wanted to make was that central assessment would use an income approach, not just the cost approach, but an income approach that essentially could be viewed. This is one view, not the only view, but could be viewed as making the property tax basically a function of the business cash flow, almost a mathematical function of, certainly a strong relationship between the business cash flow and the property tax amount. Therefore, you would have a situation where if the business cash flow increases 10% in 1 year or 20%, the property tax would go up by 10 or 20%. One view of it is that the property tax then becomes a tax on income, an income tax, actually technically a gross cash flow or a cash flow tax, rather than maybe the more traditional view of the property tax. That was the point that I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When this is probably directed to Mr. Osborne, when the income approach is used, I am assuming that the department has to make some calculation. They certainly have all of your income information from your tax filings, but not necessarily when we're looking at a company that provides voice over internet, broadband, a multiplicity of services. How do they come back and assess on a central assessment basis using the income approach unless they know all of the elements of cost and the breakdown?
Sir, it's an excellent question. I do not actually have all the information to provide a good answer, but it's a very good question.
Representative, I will note that we have that the department will be up later, and I think that would be a great question to direct to them.
Thank you.
Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate
your
testimony.
The opportunity.
Ron Northcraft, John Powell, please.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming...
And Jenny Lang, thank you.
While they're coming forward, I would say that there is also then the concern...
I'm sorry, just those first two. We'll hear from Jenny in a minute. Thank you. Representative Butler.
The concern happens that what happens when one of those companies sells and there is this increase in the valuation for the intangible at that point, unless it's broken down in the actual sale. So... I
think that's a great question to ask Mr. Phillips.
Okay.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I'm Ron Northcraft, Douglas County Assessor. I'm representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I'm here in opposition to House Bill 3064 and 3065. You've just heard about the difficulty in defining what an intangible is. Our county and the rest of Oregon has been in a 12-year court battle discussion over definition of other appraisal problems, and that's the low-income housing. My county is, just in the past year, in taxing districts, we have processed or and in the process of working refunds that exceed $1 million. That's from one county. In one question regarding the definition of low-income housing, 12 years. I think to enter into the intangible, you're just offering another opportunity for that type of legal battle to develop, and it just is going to be a large battle that I don't think we need to take on at this time. The two House bills will cost the counties, and I use the values that will come off, and it's just the county portion. It's not all the taxing districts. But it looks to me like those two bills will be approximately $6.4 million per year. My county, Douglas County, right now is in a crisis with our potential loss of forest revenues. We stand to lose approximately 68% of our annual income. The remaining counties in my district, the potential loss ranges from 33 to 68%. We can't afford to enter into another 12-year battle or long discussion court case regarding how do we define an appraisal problem and make refunds on it. So I would urge that you vote against these two bills. Any questions?
Thank you. We'll get to those in a minute. Mr. Powell and Ms. Lang, I apologize. This would be a good time for you to come forward. Yeah. I misread the registration form, and I apologize for that.
I thought she was on both sides of this issue.
No, she isn't. She isn't, in fact. I simply misread it. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing AT&T and Singular Wireless. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'll be brief as per your opening instructions. But again, just to make it clear, AT&T support and Singular supports both of these bills. And obviously, the one that removes intangibles completely would be our preference. The issue that and it's been defined for you is that if you're centrally assessed, intangibles are included. If you're assessed by a local taxing authority, then intangibles are not included in the value. So our situation in a very competitive environment, and the previous witnesses gave you some indication of that competition with VoIP, other issues that are forthcoming. We're kind of all in the same tax pot, and so our plea would be to exempt intangibles. Our neighboring states of Washington, California, Idaho, Montana, Utah, and Arizona do not tax intangibles. If you were in a corporate office planning expansion and you wanted to locate a sizable facility in your service area, and Oregon and these other states were in contention, tax policy sometimes makes a difference. So we would urge you as a company that wants to invest in Oregon, that you'd give these bills very, very serious thought. And we would be glad to cooperate with your committee and the local governments on some kind of a transition if that's necessary as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jenny Lang. I won't repeat what others had said, but we would agree, certainly in support of House Bill 3065, that it is time to begin to recognize that the world of telecommunications has changed dramatically and that some kind of a transition needs to occur on the matter of intangible property. We have been a centrally assessed company for many, many years. As one of the old traditional telephone companies, most of the centrally assessed entities are what would have been considered in the last century monopolies. That is no longer the case for telecommunications. And what we now run up against is that while we pay taxes on intangible property, our primary competitor, which is, in fact, the cable company business, is taxed as an industrial taxpayer, and therefore they do not pay property tax on intangibles. So it's the disparity between the two parts of the telecommunications industry that is difficult for us. We have worked on this issue. I've worked on this issue in this building for the last 17 years or so, and we've had varying degrees of success in passing some kind of legislation in one or both houses, but we've never been successful in going the distance. I would agree with Mr. Powell that we have looked at a variety of ways of trying to minimize the impact on local governments. We've talked about transition plans, and we would certainly be willing to engage in those kinds of discussions again. But the fact is that the surrounding states have managed to figure out ways to do this, and we believe that it is long overdue for us to engage in this kind of a discussion and come to a resolution of this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. And colleagues, what I propose is that we ask questions now of the two representatives of the telecommunications companies. I have at least one more assessor to call, and we'll hold Mr. Northcraft over for questions of them when we get there. So if you have questions now for Ms. Lang or Mr. Powell, that would be the time. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. I would say I do have one question for Quest. If I understand your testimony, I think what you said is that you would prefer that intangibles were not taxed to data companies, but that if they are to be taxed, that you prefer that all of the data companies be treated the same way.
Yes, and thank you for that question, Mr. Chair. One of the comments that Mr. Dewey made is that the trying to differentiate between how much of the infrastructure or the plant is dedicated to provision of video services versus the provision of two-way telecommunication services. That creates a whole new set of problems as far as we would be concerned, because then you're asking the Department of Revenue or whoever to literally divide up the property and determine on any given in any given tax year how much of it should be taxed in one way or the other. And it reminds me of the beginning of the breakup of the Bell system now almost 25 years ago, when people thought that they could determine what was data processing versus what was telecommunications. And that distinction is ridiculous at this stage for us to even try to contemplate. So I would suggest that we wouldn't want to try to go with that route, and that we either need to be all in or all out, and not try to identify which central offices or which fiber cable runs are offering which kinds of services.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, to both Jenny and John, you have both data transmission services and multiple operations, I guess multiple kinds of operations that are do you separate for the Department of Revenue the disparate parts of your operation so that they can come in and make that calculation, or is that something that they
make on their own. I'd like to hear it. In addition, from we'll hear from John Phillips later on, but I'd like to know what the practice is in the industry.
Mr. Chairman, we do not. We do not make that distinction.
And Mr. Chairman, and Representative Butler, I couldn't answer that question. I'd assumed that perhaps there was a form that is used by the Department of Revenue, but I do not know the answer to that. In fact, I was going to just ask for recognition to let you know I'm entering a letter for the record from AT&T from Mr. John McNamara, the regional tax director, and he was unable to be here today, and I wish he was, because he could answer that in a heartbeat. And we will get you an answer pending the Department of Revenue's answer.
Mr. Chair, my concern is this, and we'll hear it, I guess, from the Department of Revenue. My concern is that if you have a telephone company that does wireless, that does voice over internet, that maybe sells some cable time and some television shows, and pretty soon we're not talking about the future, we're talking about now, and they decide to get into the bottling business and they provide their income tax returns, then chances are, if they're making a real killing off of the bottling business, that then we have the bottling business become centrally assessed. And that isn't what was ever intended with regard to the law. So
I think that would be a great question to ask Mr. Phillips again.
Thank you. One more question. You have alternately used the name AT&T and the name Singular. What is the status of the company's name at this time?
Mr. Chair.
Or this week, I should say.
This week. It is AT&T, it is the Singular, the new AT&T. That's what I know.
Thank you. That's who writes your check.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much.
I get a check. I don't care who writes it.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. I have one other assessor who I know of on the list, and that's Pickard. Are there other assessors on my list who were planning to testify today? I'd like to make a panel. Annette, would you come up and join Mr. Northcraft and give your testimony? Again, I apologize for getting everybody out of order.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Annette Spickard. I'm the assessor and tax collector for Lane County. I'm here today to ask you to consider the following points. Number one, do not pass either of these bills. Two, the cost of property tax exemptions in Oregon, according to the most recent tax expenditure report, already amounts to $17.9 billion in lost revenues to local governments. With the current property tax system, we no longer operate a tax-based system. We operate a rate-based system. Every new exemption you create equates to a direct loss in revenue to local governments. We no longer shift the burden onto other taxpayers in order to collect the full levy authority of each district. Third, every session, there is statewide pressure for the legislature to review these expenditures and to close loopholes as an alternative to raising taxes or other revenues to meet the cost of providing public safety and education services to Oregonians. Passing either of these two bills just adds another loophole for an income-producing entity to avoid its share of the tax burden for maintaining the quality of life that cities, schools, and law enforcement provide for everyone, including their employees and customers. Counties and schools are facing fiscal crises in various degrees across the state due to the non-renewal of the federal Secure Rural Schools funding. Add to that the structural handcuffs of our current property tax system, and cities, counties, and schools are severely restricted in how they can raise revenue necessary to serve their citizens. Do not further minimize the taxable assets of corporations operating in this state by granting an unnecessary exemption as proposed by these two bills. It is the wrong time to pull more value off of the county's tax rolls when many are faced with the loss of other funds. Chair Barnhart, your committee has been concerned about this issue, and you asked me how can this committee help counties and schools facing this disinvestment by the federal government, and my answer to you is do not create any new exemption programs. Oregon already grants over 100 different property tax exemptions, and they are costly to administer. For example, the magnitude of all exemptions in my county is worth $1.1 billion of value taken off the roll. The value of this one exemption statewide is $1.4 billion, more than the exempt value of all the eligible properties in my entire county. It is not reasonable. This exemption will take another $100 million off the roll in Lane County, which equates to an 8% jump in exempt value in our county, which is a significant swing in value. Additionally, I point out the impact to school funding, which will put more pressure on the state general fund to backfill their lost revenue. And in our county, school tax makes up almost half of the tax I collect. And I would also point out that counties already get the short end of the stick from the state in regards to taxation of communication companies. ORS 758.010 forces counties to allow communication companies to use their rights of way for communication service lines free of charge. Cities can tax this use, but counties cannot. By creating these exemptions, you are further allowing communication companies to profit at the expense of local government. And I also asked several other questions. What is the return on investment to the state or local governments for granting this exemption? Will it create more jobs and more income tax? Will it provide or, improve any local conditions for schools or other public services? I don't think so. Will they pass their tax savings on to their consumers? Past experience with the way utilities have charged ratepayers to cover tax burdens that weren't necessary tells me it is doubtful when they are pressed to be making money for their shareholders. Do not be dazzled or confused about by their complaints about valuation methodology. By granting these exemptions, you will be allowing these companies a double deduction to reduce their tax liability. The cost of the intangible asset is already deducted from a company's operating income, which reduces their tax liability and market value. To allow them to again be able to deduct the value of the asset after they have been appraised upon the lower net operating income would be wrong. An analysis of this issue by the International Association of Assessing Officers is provided in your packet. It's a lengthy article, but on point, which I think you would find an interesting read. And as other people have already testified, the taxation of intangible assets is an issue across the country. But please, if you pass this legislation, be aware that other centrally assessed companies will have their hands out for an exemption, too. This is only one industry we're talking about here. Please beware of the slippery slope. I would also point out, after listening to some of the testimony, that these entities are also benefiting from the same property tax limitations under Measure 5 that everybody else does, namely the $5 and $10 caps. And so they do get tax limitations under the Constitution already. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you very much, Assessor Northcraft and Assessor Specker. Assessor Specker, I'm going to direct this question to you because you have kind of a unique situation in Lane County. Under the Central Assessment Program, these centrally assessed utilities include both the telecommunications folks and data transmission, as well as the electrical. Do you centrally assess, or is your utility and eWeb centrally assessed, and how much property tax do they pay?
Well, I'll have to get back to you on how much eWeb pays. I don't have that memorized. But we do have several centrally assessed accounts for both utilities and telecommunications, all of those things. But I'd be happy to send you the details on eWeb specifically when I get back to the office.
So just to follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Yes, please.
So you're telling me that eWeb pays as much per utility customer as somebody across the street that isn't an eWeb customer for centrally assessed taxation, property taxes?
I don't know how to answer that because I don't know what the comparison is. Maybe, yeah, I don't know how to answer that question. I'm sorry. What I can do, though, is look at what eWeb's costs are, but since they're not a communications company, I didn't come prepared to talk about electrical and power utilities. But I'm happy to follow up and get you some information on their account if you'd like.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your very much appreciate your testimony today.
You're welcome.
Let's see. Morgan Cowling, Andy Shaw, Steve Manton.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. The League of Cities is opposed to both of these bills.
Would you state your name for the record?
Sorry, Andy Shaw with the League of Oregon Cities. We are opposed to both of these measures, primarily because of the very significant loss of revenues these bills would establish. Very briefly, proposals to exempt intangibles are not new. They've been before the legislature many times. In 1995, there, in 1998, actually, a group was brought together by the Department of Revenue with representing industry, local government, and other interests, a stakeholders group. That group came to no consensus because the industries couldn't agree amongst themselves and local government and industries couldn't agree about the appropriateness of exempting intangibles. That same year, in 1998, the League of Cities commissioned a report on intangible taxation that showed there wasn't much factual basis to back up the need for a tax break. It also demonstrated that Measures 5 and 50 actually shifted the property tax burden significantly from businesses and centrally assessed businesses in particular to residential taxpayers. So the burden of property taxation actually shifted under those measures. I just wanted to comment back on the McDonald's example. I think that's a bad example because companies like McDonald's are not actually centrally assessed. They don't have the kind of assets that would cause them to become centrally assessed. So that kind of burger stand to burger stand comparison is not all that apt in our view. One other note we'd make is there's really no history of appeals of any company's intangible valuation. None of these companies have used administrative procedures to dispute how the overall value was arrived at. There have been appeals about what the unit of these industries is and other disputes of that nature, but none that say that Department of Revenue has been incorrectly assessing the intangible versus other portions of their value. On other states, generally, from what we've seen, at least in the western states, is that those states that have exempted intangibles haven't truly exempted intangibles. They've just given a blanket tax break of some proportion of the value, which is an effort to get at the intangible value, but doesn't really exempt intangibles because of the difficult nature of doing that. So for all of those reasons, we would oppose these proposals and hope you will help us maintain our revenue stability in these troubling times. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Manton. I'm here for the Office of Management and Finance for the City of Portland. Mr. Chair, HB 3064 is a bill to cap the total intangible property tax on a centrally assessed communications company. And 3065, I'm sorry, is the one to do the total cap, and 3064 is to do a 20% cap on that. And this would continue the trend of further reducing the tax base against which property taxes are levied. This cap and or exemption would further shift the property tax burden from centrally assessed businesses to the residential taxpayer that began with Measures 5 and 50. In 1998, the League of Oregon Cities commissioned a report that demonstrated 3 points. Number one, that centrally assessed industries were transferring tangible assets for accounting purposes to intangible assets at a rapid rate. The telecommunication industry was leading the way with an average annual growth rate of intangible assets book value of 260%. In other words, they were transferring assets to the very area that they now want to cap for taxation purposes. Number two, the share of property tax revenue paid by centrally assessed industries declined by 33% after Measures 5 and 50, while the relative share for individual residential property taxpayers increased by 16%. And number three, with the reduction of property taxes, the state tax burden for industry dropped Oregon to one of the lowest in the nation. Since that time, there's been no change in relative distribution of property tax burden on different sectors. Any reduction in the intangible tax methodology would further exacerbate the inequity between residential taxpayers and centrally assessed business taxpayers. It would also mean a reduction in local tax collections for school districts and a corresponding increase in state funds to maintain legislative funding levels for schools. For these reasons, we ask that you vote no on both measures 3064 and 3065. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thanks, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Cowling with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm actually here today because our resident tax expert, Gil Riddell, is out of town. So I will refer you to the written testimony submitted to by Gil or Mr. Riddell in opposition to both House Bill 3065 and House Bill 3064. There are three major areas that we're concerned about. One, this legislation would open up the potential for more litigation. Two, it would be expensive for taxpayers. And three, it's poor tax policy. For a greater explanation of those concepts, I'll refer to you to his testimony. And also, I'd like to remind the committee that this comes at a particularly difficult time for the counties. As both of the assessors before me mentioned, we are facing a significant loss of revenue from the PL 106-393, the federal timber payments. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions or get those questions to Mr. Riddell and get back to you and follow up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I have one, and it's one that I suspect Representative Butler can answer, but I'm going to ask the City of Portland. How do you transfer an asset from a tangible asset to an intangible asset? I imagine a tangible asset is something physical I can lay my hands on, and an intangible asset is something else. How do you do that?
Mr. Chair, first, I'm not an accountant. And secondly, we commissioned that report with two separate economists, Robert Whalen from Eco Northwest and Robert Young from Robert Young & Associates. They had considerable experience with the electrical utility industry and did quite a bit of research in terms of all this. And so what they did was they looked at the filings both with the FCC and with FERC for both the utilities, telecommunications, and other operators, so that they could see how the assets that they were being taxed on were booked for them. And that's how they did it. They noted that certain contracts were moved over from one side to another in the course of different things. And so that's where they were saying that they saw those asset changes.
Thank you. The contract for the use of a piece of equipment is an intangible, whereas the piece of equipment, if you own it yourself, is a tangible. For example.
Yes.
Thank you. That's very interesting. I hadn't thought of that as an idea.
And, Mr. Chair, that's largely driven by income tax policy relative to the depreciation.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Butler. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Mr. Phillips.
Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Just have a few comments about these bills. They both, 3064 and House Bill 3065, create an exemption for intangible property for centrally assessed companies that are in the communication service business. House Bill 3065 simply exempts all intangible property of these businesses, but it does not define intangible property and does not provide a methodology. From tax administration standpoint, I want to mention three points. The first is our concern about future litigation. We do not, as I've testified here many, many, many times, we do not separately assess the assets of centrally assessed companies. We appraise these companies as units, as an operating unit, and that is because the law requires it. It's standard practice nationally, and because we don't have another reason is we don't have the staff to go out nationally and inspect facilities. And the final reason, which is probably the most important reason, is that's the way the market looks at property when they go to buy these types of companies. They don't inspect each individual asset, but they look at the company as a whole. It's a holistic approach. So if we take another tact with this and divide up assets, we have an issue. How do we resolve that issue? One way is, as has been mentioned, the cost approach. This way we're looking at the cost of everything involved, the tangible property, the intangible property. If we appraise these companies based on the cost approach, we can separate out certain intangible things, and we're pretty much wholly dependent on them to tell us what the costs are. That means we have to value the tangible property then also, which means we can't value it as a unit. So it pretty much eliminates the unitary valuation method for us, and we have to pick another way to do that. That other way may be cost also. So we're basically shifting the entire appraisal to cost approach. That's fine. There is a concern about that in that the law requires us to appraise property to 100% of real market value. Market value means what a reasonable buyer and a reasonable seller would exchange property for in an arm's length transaction. What would you pay for your home that you're thinking about buying or selling? You know, that's the question. It applies to large businesses also. So cost is not always equal value. And you had a very, very real example of that recently. You talked about, and we had hearings on, a pipeline that goes to Coos County. That's a very was a very expensive project, but it doesn't yield a lot of income. So if you just look at the cost approach, you're going to have a higher value than if you look at a holistic approach to the value of that pipe. We look at the whole company and what does it contribute to the Northwest Natural Gas Company. That's just an example. We also know that...
And if I may, that's a situation in which using the income approach actually reduces the value,
Mr. Chair,
as compared to a cost approach.
That's exactly correct.
Thank you. Go ahead.
One example we looked at recently showed that a company had reported in their 10-Ks, which is it's a non-confidential form that they don't necessarily file with us, and I can completely disclose this to you. A 10-K that they file is an annual statement for the Securities and Exchange Commission. One company, a large communication company, reports over 70% of their assets are intangible. I don't expect they would do any differently when we come to challenging a value that we would assert based on a cost approach. So that may or may not be in the revenue impact, but that's a 10-K that I have in my hands. And finally, implementing this bill, particularly 3065, has a really tight timeline for us. I don't think we can actually make that because we have already are at the end of our value determination process, and we will be sending out in another week or so the values to the companies, which they can then respond to. So I'm sure by the time if this became law, it would be too late for us to actually make the changes for this upcoming tax year. The bill also has a revenue impact for which we attempted to provide information to your legislative revenue office for, but that's not necessarily our issue, so I'll leave that to those for whom it applies. House Bill 3064 is slightly different in how it characterizes the exemption because it provides a methodology. It actually specifically provides for the cost approach. It directs us to do that, and then it limits the intangible assets of the total value to 20%. We can simply pull these booked values off forms like the 10-K or some other form and say this is what they booked as an asset, this is how they've accounted for it, and this is the value we'll have to attribute to it based on this cost approach. Again, you have the issue of whether or not we are complying with the law in determining the actual real market value of that property. And then it's fairness to everybody else in the system who pays taxes. The 20%, my final point on 3064 is the 20% may or may not work out to be a significant amount because 20% of a small amount is a small amount. 20% of 70%, if your total assets are 70% and you take 20% of that only, then you're talking about a significant reduction. So the numbers, if you're assuming that the intangibles are a small portion of the total value, that might not be a correct assumption. Finally, my concern on both of these two bills has to do with federal implications because we do have some federal legislation in what's commonly referred to as the 4R Act and TEFRA, which are acts that in your handout, I've spelled it out for acronym-averse individuals. I don't remember them actually, but Railroad Regulatory Reformation Act or something, and the other one deals primarily with airlines. And the airlines and the railroads have been active nationally in promoting the uniformity that's ensured through those acts. And I can see that it doesn't take a large leap to figure out that if I was not having my intangibles exempt and I was centrally assessed, that I would assert that that act. So that's my testimony. I'd be happy to answer questions or respond to earlier points for which I have a lot of notes.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, Mr. Witt, Representative Witt, I beat you out on
I looked the wrong way.
Well, we're way down here on the left end.
Did you want to go first? Would you like to go first?
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Please, Representative Witt.
Some of us stuck way over here on the left wing. If our fulcrum's long enough and we're out here enough, we can balance the weight of those on the other side.
Okay. I think that remark is out of order, Representative Witt.
I agree, Mr. Chairman. And because of that, I'll defer to my good colleague.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
He forgot his question.
No.
Thank you, Representative Williams.
John, you mentioned in your testimony, in your written form, it says under House Bill 3065, and I'm just kind of curious, and I think you've kind of shared this and everything, but I just want to revisit it again and just hear it specifically from you now. It does not define intangible property and does not provide a methodology. What would happen if both those existed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, some states have been more specific in their exemptions. I think it was mentioned earlier that there's something like 13 states that do still tax intangibles, and the rest don't. And the don't part, those that are in that category have varying forms of it. Some of them have the form that they specify which intangibles are exempt. Other ones provide a flat rate. There's a little bit of a handful of different ways they have done that. And we have no experience with that. We don't have an experience with that kind of an appraisal or that methodology, so I really don't know how to answer that, but there are some examples of that.
Okay, and I just have one other question.
Please.
There was some testimony regarding data company earlier. Can you explain to me what that is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I'll try to do that. I think... the point about the data companies is an interesting one, and I'm not so sure that it's on point, however, because what we're charged in the statute with appraising centrally is certain businesses and services. One among those is communications. Now, it doesn't say one among those is data transmission. It's communications. So if you want to focus on data, then I think you'd be misreading the statute. I think what it is, it's a communication company or business that is either telephone, telegraph, or data transmission by whatever method. I think that's pretty close to the actual words. So to take the data transmission and put it in the front of the word communication, I think would be sort of a misread. If we subjected... in this state, every entity that transmitted data to central assessment, I have a very hard time thinking about who would not be included.
Yeah.
Now, Google, for example, I'm sure they transmit data. But what is their business? Is their business to create a database so that when you go and put in a search word, you get hits? I think their business and service is a database. And I think they use communications as a tool. They use internet service providers to launch their service, but I don't think that they're centrally accessible because they're involved with data transmission. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Phillips, we've had testimony from a couple of the counties in the League of Oregon Cities that they anticipate that the passage of these bills would result in, I guess, significant revenue losses to them. Do you have any figures on how much that revenue loss might amount to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, we have done some estimations based on some assumptions, because, as I said, we don't appraise these types of properties discreetly. And some of those assumptions are based on actual reports by several of the major companies. And I provided that information to your Legislative Revenue Office, and I believe that was built into the revenue impact. Do you have the revenue impact?
Sure.
Okay. I have not seen all of the math involved with how that's built in, but Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, I do have the documents that we provided to Mary in your Legislative Revenue Office.
Okay.
And I can tell you what our bottom lines were, but I know that we did not factor in changes with the projections that an economist would use.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Witt.
Am I, John, am I pinning you down too much to, I'm hunting here for those figures.
I think Mary can give them to us.
I found it.
Oh, you found it?
It should be in
your packet.
Oh, yeah.
My packet's got now. My file has now got a lot of material in it, so it takes a minute.
I'm sorry, I need to. I'll wait for it here.
Mary's revenue impact statement for this year for
$20 million, it looks like
is around is $23 million.
Yeah.
For HD 3065, local and school districts, and then the other one I don't have it handy. Mary, what is this?
For 3064?
Yes.
The first year impact in 08-09 would be roughly $8 million, $8.5 million total, split out across the local and local jurisdictions. And, of course, I'm using your data, so I really just went with their methodology, and it's based on 125 centrally assessed communications companies. I don't believe that included any concept for incorporating the cable companies in the year, does it?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay, so
we don't have those values, so we didn't incorporate
those.
So these are
preliminary numbers.
Do note that both of these statements have the big word preliminary on them.
Yeah, yeah.
So that number is going to change if we get any further with these bills.
I might add, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
The actual impact from the cable companies probably wouldn't factor in because they're not currently included, so there would be no intangible value coming off the tax rolls for them. So that part shouldn't have a... It should be a wash.
Thank you.
I want to make certain I understand what we just were talking about. These negative numbers on these two preliminary revenue impact statements are the reduction in intangible, based on the reduction in intangible assessment for companies which are already centrally assessed.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
If these bills were to pass.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Now I understand it. Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of comments, John, getting back to make sure that I understand. If a centrally assessed company, which is a data transmission company, also has amongst its assets a soft drink company, how do you separate that out when you get ready to assess the soft drink company, and let's assume the soft drink company is assessed locally? How do you centrally assess the balance of it without knowing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, thank you for that question and the asking it earlier, so I have time to think about it, especially. But I think in our experience, we've found a lot of centrally assessed companies that have spin-off small secondary focuses. Like, we don't typically wouldn't have an airline like Delta, for example, that would run a smaller operation to in a printing business, let's say. So we're not seeing a lot of that. I chatted with our folks who are in that area, and we weren't really able to come up with any examples.
Berkshire Hathaway.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Berkshire Hathaway.
I don't know what you're referring to.
I
know who Berkshire Hathaway is, but
yeah, Mid America. They've got centrally assessed utilities all over the United States.
McDonald's, Coca-Cola. Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler. And this was mentioned earlier. Some of the litigation comes around what's the definition of the unit of property, okay. And so if a company is a multinational company or a large national company, we certainly want to just assess the unit. And we have had some disagreement, as I think Mr. Shaw testified earlier. Not a lot of challenges legally on what's intangible or what's the value of this intangible, but what is the unit of property? And if we can narrow in on that, then that's the part that should be centrally assessed.
Can I jump to a second point that has been brought out here, and that is if hamburger stands were in fact centrally assessed, McDonald's would be assessed at a larger amount than the next door stand of hamburgers, Butler BP Burgers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think I would have to respond that every individual circumstance is going to have to be looked at differently. It depends on where that McDonald's is located. Location is one of the key factors in determining value of property. If you put it one place versus another, it would make a difference. So if it has a franchise, that's something that's probably going to be looked at differently, and yeah, but I really can't say on across the board.
Okay, following up now, Mr. Chair, relative to the 70% intangibles, when companies report on their 10-K that they're 70% intangible, does that intangible, that portion that's intangible, perhaps include appreciation on assets, including purchase of bandwidth at favorable prices?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we don't audit these statements, so we really don't know. We're just saying that this is what they report. We use, we may look at that to sort of check it against the forms they filed to get some sense, but it's not really controlling in terms of how we determine the actual value.
Kind of a final question, if I may, Mr. Chair, in this regard, and I'm concerned about this, particularly when we start talking about transmission of data and recognizing that anywhere in the world our competition is never more than an eighth of a second away from us. If, in fact, companies who are organized in Oregon wanted to go ahead and, for an economic reason, not choose to do more than just sales in Oregon, for which they will be taxed under the current apportionment program, is there any reason why they shouldn't build their buildings, employ their people, and do other kinds of things out of state, away from a state that has Oregon's intangible taxation, and merely just go ahead and lease much of their other operation, which they would be paying out so that their Oregon income would be much less, causing the overall value of the intangible asset to be, in effect, arbitrarily skewed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I think that goes beyond my realm of expertise in tax administration and would go more into tax policy. Do we want to keep people in state? What's the incentive? How much would it take? I don't know.
But I need to follow up, Mr. Chair, because the testifier and I have already talked about this, and that is, in fact, the United States has already driven some of these companies offshore out of country, where I think there's a company by the name of Vonage that has only a boilerplate in the United States, or a boiler room, I beg your pardon, boiler room in the United States where they just collect the fees and everything is done offshore. My concern is that when we move to data transmission, we might move it all to India and have a very, very small amount. So my concern is, have you seen any indication that these companies, which appear to be, as a result of the instruments that we're carrying around with us, appear to be growing exponentially, is there any indication that they are, in fact, on the records which you have for centrally assessing these operations, that they are, in fact, growing at 10 to 20% per annum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I would have to go back and look at the values over time and to see whether they're growing or flat or decreasing. I just don't know. I don't know about that.
Intuitively, you don't think that they're increasing in value?
I don't know.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry.
No, sir.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Mr. Phillips? I don't see any. Are there others who would like to be heard on House Bill 3064 or House Bill 3065? Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And what I really want you to think of is me as the stupid Ralph Groner. He would normally be here. He knows this stuff inside and out. I am obligated on behalf of my organization to just get up and make a very clear and distinct question or statement. We are opposed to 3064 and 3065 because they cost our local governments money. Right now, we are faced with unprecedented income deficits because of a variety of reasons, not the least of which is timber funding and the inability of Congress to come to any kind of a conclusion on whether or not they're going to continue that funding replacement. Until that is resolved, we are sort of unilaterally opposed to anything that reduces income further at the local levels or hampers our ability to properly fund local government. And if you talk to people, the government they are the most happy with is the government which is in their backyard. And the one with which they feel like they have the most control over. And to shackle their ability to continue to raise funds appropriately is just not in our best interest. And we are a union that represents a lot of local government entities. And so until we can get a better handle on sort of the funding base that we're going to be operating off of for the next few years, we would appreciate it if you would not sort of hamstring us any more than we already are.
Thank you.
And please don't ask me any questions.
More attractive.
Or I will go find Ralph and bring him.
Thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Appreciate your testimony. Are there others who would like to be heard on these two bills? Yes, sir. Please come forward.
I'll be brief. My name is, Mr. Chair, thank you, members. My name is David Lawson. I'm Yamhill County Assessor. I've been in the mass appraisal business since 1988 in the government sector, been elected for 7 years. The erosion of the property tax base has been substantial through my years in government. We have created exemptions for about every business imaginable. This rhetoric that Oregon's not a good state to do business in, I think, is really a misnomer. For instance, in my county, Lowe's big box store comes on at $16 million RMB. It's taxable as 44% because of changed property ratios. So I've got a $16 million facility being taxed at 8.2 or whatever the math is. So in the scope of taxation in corporate America, I believe they have some responsibility to pay their fair share. Quest is here, I think, one of the people asking for this exemption. 3 years ago, they received a substantial reduction in their values through the appeal process. My rates don't go down any, keeps going up. You know, they have investors they want to return on and of their investment, and they use the income capitalization approach to get there. But when it doesn't work for them on the bottom line, they want some other cost approach. I think we have a responsibility as the leaders of this state to take a hard look at the exemptions that we give out. We should undo some of them. And I wanted to be on the record. I'm just speaking for myself, not the Assessors Association, although I'm second vice president, but I listen to the rhetoric, and it doesn't make sense to reality. So I just wanted to be on the record.
Thank you very much, sir. Questions for Mr. Lawson? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Other testimony today on House Bill 3064, House Bill 3065. I don't see anybody leaping forward, so we'll close the public hearing on those two bills.
Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move for suspension of the rules so that Representative Diane Rosenbaum can vote on House Bill 2961A.
Representative Butler moves for a suspension of the rules to allow Representative Rosenbaum to vote on the on House Bill 2961A. Is there an objection? I don't see any objections. Representative Rosenbaum, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Representative Rosenbaum votes aye on House Bill 2961. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative Butler. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2625.
Afternoon.
Thank you. Mazin, tell us about this bill.
You kind of cleared the room, Mr. Chair.
I think we did. They knew you were coming.
House Bill 2625A comes to you from the House Committee on Energy and Environment. When it started as 2625, amended and became A, engrossed. What the bill attempts to do is create this funding mechanism, mostly through a fund financed through in the Department of Energy through lottery bonds. And it puts the maximum amount for those lottery bonds at $985,000. And those lottery bonds in the fund would be used in grants. Those grants would be given to companies that we will be looking in investments and studies on fuel cell systems. In order to get the seed money for the research and the work. The bill also puts some requirements for these funds. The $50,000 also is included as a limit for those funds. And at the beginning of the hearing, Mr. Chair, we've received Dash 2 amendment. I think we have those. Did we pass those to the committee? These just came right before the...
Well, I don't think I have it. Maybe I do. I do have it.
Okay.
Have other members seen it?
No.
2625, the Dash 2 amendment.
So we have, you have it. You have it right there. Okay. Sorry for the confusion, but because those we didn't have them previously, we just asked for 25 copies. And
no, you did.
I'm not going to talk much about those since I haven't had... more than basically look at it and see that the Dash 2 do some reordering of the statute or the bill itself in order, as I understand it, to make a certain cleanup that is necessary. Finally, Mr. Chair, for this program at the $985,000 bonds, lottery bonds, in order to make that effective, The state treasurer usually, if they want to go and bond, they don't necessarily utilize $985,000 only or that small amount. What they do is they bundle a group of requests until they get up to something like $20 million or so, or $25 million and above, and then they bond that. And if that happens and they're able to bond it for 15 years, in a taxable bond, the payments on those bonds would be $117.3 for the 15 years. However, if it's a 10-year bond, the payments will be about $153.5 coming out of the lottery portion that otherwise would be for discretionary spending for the legislature.
Thank you. I see that the sponsors of the bill, two of the sponsors of the bill are here. So if you'd like, we'll hear from you first. Senator Westland, Representative Burley.
You just want me to dive right in?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, and I very much appreciate you hearing this bill and moving it forward in the process. This is important for our district. It's important for the state of Oregon. And, you know, this isn't a bill about three Oregon companies who want help from the state. You know, this is a much larger issue than that. It's an issue of Oregon's priority and about promoting our brand as a clean, environmental state. And we can choose to move forward and embrace this new technology, or we can let it passes by and someone else will seize that opportunity. I'll say a few words about that in a minute. But Oregon, as we all know and appreciate, has a history of being in the forefront of great new ideas. Our very identity is intertwined in the connection between the economy and the environment, and I proffer such Oregon accomplishments as the Beach Bill, Bottle Bill, and our land use planning system as three examples. You know, this session we can continue that tradition by prioritizing our values and put projects that focus on energy and the environment to the forefront. This bill represents just such a union. Fuel cell technology is one of the most promising technological advances in the past 20 to 30 years. It is real, and it promises to take a variety of fuels, especially new biofuels, and provide clean, reliable, efficient electricity and power. This isn't just a figment of my or our collective imaginations. I mean, fuel cells are here. The technology has matured and prices have come down to the point where we see fuel cell used in many applications, and we will continue to see them expand in the next few years. The most promising applications are more remote locations such as cell phone towers and remote sites that need power, remote monitoring stations for agencies like ODOT, the Oregon State Police, ODFW, and auxiliary power for homes, RVs, and boats. Just a few years old, this is a market that is already measured in the billions of dollars annually. Someone is going to supply these fuel cells, and it can and should be Oregon. We lead in this tremendously promising area of technology, and I believe this field has the potential to rival biotechnology, open source software, even the chip industry in its employment in our state if we do this right and embrace the future. And just as we have helped each of those industries along the way, we need to give a leg up to the Oregon companies that are trying to drive this market, drive the volume up, prices down, and field test their technologies so they can be a significant part of this multi-billion dollar international market. Other states are way ahead of us. Connecticut, a small state with a budget not much in excess of ours, has already granted $10 million to their local companies. Ohio, obviously a larger state, has a $62 million program. And Germany, which would love to have the market all to themselves, is investing over $100 million. We are asking for less than $100 million, we are asking for less than a million. Now, I know that's a ways and means question, and that's why this bill is has a prior reference to ways and means. But we are asking only for $1 million. It's small, but it's a start. This bill doesn't envision direct payments to these three Oregon companies, although we've done that for Oregon or other Oregon industries in this state. Rather, the bill provides state agencies and some private commercial companies that might have a need for fuel cells a way to acquire these systems and field test them in their place of business. It's a market-driven approach. The program requires that the Oregon Department of Energy run these programs and expects investments to be targeted and worthy of funding. State agencies are already clamoring to get a hold of these systems, but their current budgets don't allow that to take place. This bill fills that gap. This is a reasonable, rational, and responsible way to give a helping hand to Oregon companies with Oregon technology that employ Oregonians. We should enthusiastically send this bill to the Ways and Means process and make sure that our state is at the forefront of this remarkable new clean energy technology. Mr. Chair, I very much again would like to say thank you for hearing this bill and hopefully sending it on its way. I'll hold for questions till after Representative Burley has spoken.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, and I want to thank you and Senator Westland and members of the committee for this hearing today. I certainly won't take as much time as my good friend and colleague because he's said everything I think that needs to be said. this is truly a very exciting technology. When I was first introduced to this at Ida Tech in Bend, I just was enamored with this technology and think it's something that has great potential. I've spent time with them, as I, in my professional career, spend time in the woods with various state and federal agencies and looking at remote monitoring sites of various things, whether it's water quality or paired watershed studies in Hinkle Creek down outside of Roseburg. I look at applications where they're packing in marine batteries and all and trying to put solar panels up in the top of Douglas fir trees so they can power these remote sites, and all I can think about is fuel cells, fuel cells, fuel cells. So I think this bill would help us move this technology forward, help get it out in the field where people can have some hands-on experience with it, see how it works in the environment, see what the operational costs and the maintenance requirements are. And it's a simple bill. The $900,080 we're asking for is a very scientifically derived figure, as Senator Westland pointed out. And with that, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that the Dash A2 amendments you have before you are just a very simple clarification of the qualifications for these companies to meet under this bill, and we would fully support that in the bill. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, with the current price of gasoline, whether the senator and representative were going to be offering internal combustion engine conversions down in the parking garage.
If you'd like to get on the list, you'd be number 17. Brad, we can help you out.
You're going to hear from some. I know at least one witness that's following from Ida Tech, and I think there's one from another company as well. And they'll be able to get into more of the technical stuff. A good question for them would be, how does this look for the automotive industry?
Thank you very much. Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could, yes. I mean, we toured the plant with Representative Dingfelder's committee, and Ben Cannon was there, and certainly Representative Burley. This is just cool. And, I mean, you know, a unit maybe half the size of this witness stand, I mean, you can power a house, you know, for emergency supply power. And the great thing that I remember is we're walking through their new location. Everything's clean and tidy and neat. And we come to the research, R&D. And this is behind this door is world-class, leading-edge fuel cell technology research. And it was written in child's scrawl on, you know, a piece of flimsy yellow paper that was not much bigger than this, and it was R&D department and an arrow. And I just thought the contrast between this very plebeian indicator of where the R&D took place and the actual world-class, you know, research was quite charming and worthy of your consideration as well, sir.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'd ask you to ask one of the Ida Tech representatives to deny that.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have four witnesses that appear to me to be industry representatives, and we'll just call them, and you can come up in the order that you would like. Clear Edge Power, Bill Sprawl, Ida Tech, Eric Simpkins, Doug Riggs, James Davis. I know I've got four people and three chairs, but let's figure out how we're going to do it. Thank you. Part of the reason for calling you all at once is that we only have a few minutes for our hearing today. I'm willing to stay until 3 o'clock, but there are some others who may not be able to. So go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, thanks so much for having us here today and allowing us to present our views on the Power Fuel Cell Pilot Program outlined in H.R. 2625.
And for the record, would you identify yourself?
I am so sorry. Eric Simpkins, Vice President of Business Development and Government Affairs with Ida Tech.
Thank you.
Ida Tech is a small fuel cell business headquartered in Central Oregon in Bend with offices throughout the United States and in Europe. Iditech, just to familiarize you a little bit with the company, is the largest and arguably the most market-ready fuel cell company in the Pacific Northwest. We develop fuel cells for commercial applications, for civil applications, and for military applications as well. Just to define what a fuel cell is, because a lot of people struggle with this, consider it to be a battery, scalable from a few watts to megawatts, that instead of using stored fuel, is continuously supplied with the fuel and can thus continually generate electricity. And it can do so endlessly. Today, we're serving fuel cell market niches such as backup and telecom because we're mission enabling for them. And we're not giving them any cost advantages yet. This is true of the military as well, where soldiers have to carry many batteries into the field and can reduce their total weight and burden by just carrying a small fuel cell. Our industry has much experience with demonstrations. We're now validating specific applications and field trials, and that's really what this bill is about. House Bill 2625 is really about field trials, kind of past the demonstration phase. We're demonstrating fuel cells or conducting fuel cell field trials now with devices that have an established price, are certified to industry standards, and we have warranties and repair schedules for these devices. The mass market is eager to adopt fuel cell systems. When I say mass markets, home applications, commercial buildings applications, transportation. But fuel cell prices limit their ability to afford them today. HB 2625 will enable Iditech and the other fuel cell companies in Oregon to reduce the unit cost through volume manufacturing and energizing market adaption of these systems. Now, as Senator Westland pointed out, there are other states that have significantly contributed to fuel cell company evolution and maturity. He mentioned New York and Connecticut at $10 million apiece and Ohio at $62 million. Ohio has just announced another $6.7 million to be awarded in contracts for field trials and demonstrations in their state. Now, how does this bill benefit to fuel cell companies? It benefits Iditech, and it's really the only one I can talk to, by allowing us to serve our commercial and defense markets, but not only in Oregon, but on a worldwide basis. We will be adding 20 people without this bill to our 65 employee population in this calendar year. And with this bill, we think we can significantly increase the numbers of employees by reducing our unit costs and getting more units into the field. Iditech benefits Oregon with high-tech jobs. Two-thirds of our people are PhDs. And we also provide $13 million of impact annually to the Oregon economy, and that's a growing number. We also provide hydrogen and hydrogen-based fuel cell systems, which are systems that are fueled with tanks of hydrogen. But we also offer fuel cell systems that generate the hydrogen on board so we don't have to store it. And that's been one of the greatest issues in siting fuel cell systems in our country, is the storage of fuel cells, the storage of hydrogen with fuel cells on site. I sincerely appreciate your leadership on this issue. I request your full support for Bill 2625. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, gentlemen. Thank you.
Hi, my name is James Davis. I represent Hydra Fuel Cell. I'm Director of Marketing and Product Development there. I also represent, I am for, our organization is for 2625. As this gentleman stated, he basically covered 80% of what would be a code, he represents a large, what's what I'm looking for here?
Portion?
Portion, thank you, sir. It's been a long day, if you haven't noticed, with the red in my eyes that matches my maroon shirt. But He represents a lot of what we're looking to also do. Ida Tech is definitely a world-class leader in fuel cell technology. Hydra Fuel Cell has basically been in business 2 years, and we are also looking to go into the marketplace. Also doing home powered systems that would basically be a fuel cell system that would run off of like a natural gas application or a biodiesel application and those type of things to power the home. And we're also looking at doing power backup systems that will be either portable or what they'll call mobile stationary, the ability to basically take a unit like a diesel generator, if you would, that be semi-portable, put it at a location and be able to generate electricity quietly. As far as that goes, what House Bill 2625 would do for us would help us to launch our product into the marketplace also to show that the feasibility and the operation of fuel cell technology. Currently, we are definitely aware that there's an energy crisis going on, and that's definitely, you know, not late-breaking news by any means. We have an energy security issue that that we're dealing with. All of us as Americans, as far as that goes, because we know that the moment that we get cut off from domestic oil, we are going to be in a serious crisis situation, as far as that goes. One of the things that fuel cell technology is going to do for the United States is going to allow us not to be as dependent. And in conjunction with that, the nice thing about fuel cell technologies is you can use multiple different feedstocks, anything from biodiesel, vegetable oil, diesel oil, gasoline. All those sources, all those hydrocarbons can be converted into hydrogen. So at that particular point, there's definitely a very major benefit with the technology that we're looking to deploy as far as that goes. There's also, excuse me here, let me change my page. There's also environmental benefits as far as that's concerned. I won't take a lot of time about the environmental benefits, but we all know that there's major air pollution, so by using fuel cell technology, we'll really reduce the amount of CO in the air. I would just like to conclude by saying thank you for your time, and I know Bill also has something that you'd like to add, and do we have any questions?
Thank you very much. We'll go on to the rest of our panel, and then we'll come back for questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Bill Sproul. I'm Vice President of Business Development for Clear Edge Power in Hillsboro, Oregon. And Clear Edge Power really spawned out of a garage in Tigard in 2000, looking at the state-of-the-art of fuel cell technology from companies like Ida Tech and others that had been established for a while, and thinking a little bit out of the box as to how to capitalize on some of the expertise in the Silicon Forest in semiconductor processing technology to really drive down the cost and improve the reliability of fuel cells. And so we incorporated in 2003. For the last almost 4 years, we've been building the business. Today we're about 25 people, 23 of which are very capable technical people, half of which we brought in from out of the state to bring expertise into the state. We are, like Ida Tech and Hydra, focused on stationary applications versus the automobile or micro portable electronic applications. The advantages have really been touched on here, but I want to stress there's really three things that I think are making the market start to stand up and really recognize that fuel cells are a very viable alternative for the future. The cleanliness of it, we don't burn fuel. We have a catalytic reaction. If you're using hydrogen as the fuel, the only exhaust is a water vapor or water out of the fuel cell. There's no CO2, no NOx, no SOx. Even if you're converting hydrocarbons like natural gas or propane or a biodiesel, you're doing that in a catalytic reaction, not a burning reaction. So, again, you don't have the harmful emissions that you would have with an internal combustion engine type technology. So there's very significant clean environmental aspects to fuel cells. Fuel cells are very efficient. In terms of electrical generation, they're about the most efficient small-scale electrical generation technology you can come up with. Typical efficiencies are in the 35 to 50% of the energy that goes in is what you get in AC power coming out. And finally, they're very reliable. It's a solid state device. You really don't have moving parts like you do in an internal combustion engine, and lends itself to long life, long standby type situations for backup power and things like that. Ourselves were initially focused on backup applications like the cell towers and things like that that were mentioned earlier, where we'd replace lead acid batteries and offer an economical value proposition to operators and businesses that want backup reliable power. In the longer run, I think there's a huge opportunity in looking at distributed generation, and fuel cells will play a big role in that, being a quiet, clean power generation technology, operating on infrastructure fuels, natural gas, propane, biofuels, as they become more prevalent. Finally, I'd like to just summarize. We do support this, and I think one of the main benefits that I would like to see come out of this is government agencies, the Department of Energy and other Oregon government agencies, become more familiar with the operation and performance of fuel cells in real-life applications. And I think this bill offers an opportunity for some of those agencies to find some funding to be able to deploy a fuel cell, understand its implications for the future. And finally, as you can see, we're creating businesses here, spinning it out of prior technologies that we're strong in. And I think we do have the opportunity to build a fairly significant cluster of economic growth for the state here.
Thank you very much. He's going to pass. We have questions for the panel. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming forward to testify. Mr. Davis, you didn't tell us where hydrofuel cells is located. Where are you centrally located?
I apologize, Butler. Beaverton, Oregon.
Beaverton. Follow up if I may.
Yes, please.
Thank you. And I assume that the Idatec hydrofuel cells and ClearEdge Power all are have been certified as competitively selected by the Western States Contracting Alliance as qualified vendors of power fuel cells and otherwise meet the requirements of the ANSAI CSA America FC 1204 standard.
We're looking at the bill.
Representative Butler, the Western States competition took place a little over a year ago, I think. And at that point in time, ClearEdge Power was not a certified product, so we were not in that competition. I think there were amendments added to the bill to put the Department of Energy in the place of certifying qualified equipment that would fall under this.
Yes, that's in fact what.
So I think that was one of the amendments that we suggested to more be more inclusive to all the fuel cell companies.
Committee, we're looking at line 7 through 10 on the -A2 amendments. Thank you. That's a good point. Now I understand why we have the amendment. All right. Thank you. Other questions, Representative Butler?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And if I probably
may I follow up on
please.
Representative. Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, Idatec does have products which are certified to the WSCA standards as well as the national standard FC-1.
Okay. And this provides, as I read the staff measure summary, this provides four grants to agencies for a maximum of $50,000 to deploy between 35 and 50 of these fuel cells. What are the price range of the fuel cells that we're talking about? Have any idea what price ranges for state agencies, that state agencies would be looking at an average fuel cell?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, we make a variety of fuel cell products that range in size from 200 watts up to as much as 15 kilowatts. Prices very generally are directed to the particular application. But to give you just kind of a ballpark figure, at the 250-watt level, something in the range of $8,000 to $10,000, and at the 15-kilowatt level, something in the range of between $50,000 and $150,000. Depending on the particular application.
And I assume that depends, too, on what fuel you're going to use.
It's very dependent upon the fuel. It's very dependent upon the way in which the power plant will be used. They're very flexible. They generate electricity. They make a lot of excess heat, and they generate water as a byproduct. So they can be tri-generation devices if that's the user's inclination.
In Representative Butler's part of the country, there may be occasions where that water may be important. Representative Butler, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make certain that with $985,000, which is the net amount which is being made available to state agencies for grants to bring those state agencies into the fuel cell usage, that there would be enough resource here to provide the 35 to 50 fuel cells to meet the necessary demand. I'm assuming that staff has looked at this and has gotten some prices and those kinds of things, and we do have
Representative Butler, if I could add to that and put it in perspective, in commercial quantities, we fully expect that the fuel cells have to be competitive with solar and other alternative energy sources. Solar right now is in the range of $7 per watt. Depends on where you are and what incentives are in place. We would expect that the fuel cells that we're developing would get below that level fairly quickly. The other point is that we have already started doing field trial demonstration projects, and we cost share in those quite significantly. So there isn't a price list on early beta unit field trials that anybody can turn to. So the funding that's contemplated under this, I think, would be of great advantage to the state agencies to be able to participate along with the companies in deploying these.
And Mazen, have you done the math on actually the deployment of 35 to 50 of these units? Average price, it looks like the smallest 2,500 or 250 watt. Even if you said that these were going out at 50% of the grant request, that would still mean that it would be $5,000 per unit. That assumes that everybody wants the smallest one on their. It barely makes it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no, I have not investigated that direction. I think that probably the Department of Energy is the one that would be given that overall authority. So your policy decision is whether to give the Department of Energy that kind of program and allow them that fund to do that in a way a pilot at the description that it is.
Doug, do you want to add to this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs with NGRC representing IDATEC here today. And we thought about this very carefully during the drafting of the bill before we sent it down to Ledge Council in the fall. This bill was pre-session filed. The calculation at the time was approximately $20,000 per unit was the estimate at the time, and we may be below that. We'd buy approximately 50 fuel cells at the full cost. So the thinking is that we could at least get 35 to 50 fuel cells if you're in that $15,000 to $25,000 range. The hope would be at the end of the project that we can incentivize even greater numbers for the same amount of money. So there was actually a calculation that we came up with. Approximately 50 fuel cells at $20,000 adds up to around $985,000.
Do you have other questions on this topic?
The only other question I had was, why would folks at $7 per watt, which would be a couple of thousand dollars for the 250, select, and I think I know the answer, select the solar or select the fuel cell versus the solar cell, and it's really you combine the best of all of the technologies, plus it's consistently there, whether there's sunshine or not. No, thank you.
Correct. Was there any consideration given to the cost involved in collecting data to since this is planned as a demonstration project, how would we go about finding out whether the project was worthwhile and and whether the state or anybody else would be interested in buying these products in the future.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Doug Riggs for the record, we thought about that very carefully and decided that that would probably be something that we'd work on with the department during the rulemaking process. But as we envisioned it in the drafting of the bill, we would ask the companies to come up with some criteria and reporting requirements that they would put the cost of doing so, and then the department would probably have some administrative costs and overhead, but we would envision that it would be relatively minor.
So if, just to summarize, then, it would be your expectation that the companies themselves would foot the cost for the studies that would be involved, because they're the ones who would ultimately benefit from the information.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's correct. I think it's in our benefit to hopefully come back with a good news story that's backed up by the facts and the figures and be able to say, you provided X amount of money and it did the following as far as job creation and technology development.
That's correct. Thank you very much. Other questions?
Mr. Chair, just for staff, is there any requirement that this money be expended, and I'm sure that there must be somewhere here, that the Department of Energy, Oregon Department of Energy, would actually expend this money with these Oregon-based companies?
No. Mr. Chair, the Representative Butler, the requirement is only for the Department of Energy to start the granting process within 6 months of the funds being available, and as you know, with the bonding of anything, usually the bonding is tied to which projects you do at what time, and in this, the bonding is in order to go to a fund, and then the fund will spend the money on the different requirements. So it's exploratory, if you will, even in that concept itself.
Okay.
I note that on line 5 of page 3, there's a requirement that the fuel cell, the power fuel cell system, be manufactured in Oregon. And I'm assuming that we don't really mean that you make the whole thing here, but that it's assembled or...
Final assembly.
Some other...
Here in Oregon.
Right. I'm assuming you buy components all over the world, don't you?
That's correct.
Yeah. And are there other businesses that would be able to meet the standard of manufacturers, the power fuel cell systems in Oregon, that you know about?
I know of no others.
Not at this time.
But right now, we've got all three of you.
You
got the whole industry, right?
we're that's an unusual thing for an entire industry to appear in front of the committee at one time. Anything else? Gentlemen, we appreciate your presentation very much. I have some interest in the more technical aspects of fuel cells, but I won't trouble you with them now because I don't think they're related to our interest as a committee. But
probably they are, Mr. Chair. This is really great technology.
Well, the possibility of these kinds of instrumentalities for the future are pretty astounding. What little I know about them makes them very impressive to me. I'm very pleased with the fact that there are some business people who are putting their lives into making this kind of technology work. I'm very pleased to meet the three of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Anything else? With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2625. Paul, help me with this. I want to roll over the bills we did not get to today. The work session on House Bill 2793 till tomorrow. The public hearing and work session on House Bill 173, Senate Bill 173, and House Bill 2718. Really? I think I've covered it.
That's it.
Thank you very much. With that, we'll roll those over till tomorrow, add them to tomorrow's agenda, and the committee is adjourned.